Taylor's ideas spread from company to company, from industry, and from blue collars to white. There was one best way to insert paper into a typewriter, to sit at a desk, to clip pages together. They seeped into the halls of government. His philosophy of replacing the intuition of the person doing the job with reductionist efficiencies designed by a separate group of people marked a new means of organizing human endeavors. It was the behavioral soulmate for the technical advances of industrial engineering. Taylor's success represented the legitimization of management as a discipline. Previously, managerial roles were rewards for years of service in the form of higher pay and less strenuous labor. The manager's main function was to keep things in working order and maintain morale. Under Taylor's formulation, managers were both research scientists and architects of efficiency. This drew a hard and fast line between thought and action. Managers did the thinking and planning while workers executed. No longer were laborers expected to understand how or why things worked. In fact, managers saw teaching them that or paying a premium for their expertise as a form of waste. At the paper mill, Taylor encountered a system where workers submitted samples of digester fluid to a chemist at regular intervals. Taylor replaced the chemist with a rack of test tubes filled with digester fluid at varying standard conditions. Workers simply had to determine which tube was the best match to their sample and proceed accordingly. As a result, an expensive, skilled worker could be replaced with a cheap, uneducated adolescent. By devising incredibly exact instructions and printing a few charts, Taylor could again afford to lose expensive workers with decades of experience, replacing them with young laborers who were unquestioningly loyal to a centrally designed process. Taylor told workers, "I have you for your strength and mechanical ability. We have other men paid for thinking." In the book that became the Bible of his movement, The Principles of Scientific Management, he portrayed laborers as idiots, mocking their syntax and describing them as mentally sluggish. In one passage he wrote, "A laborer shall be so stupid and so phlegmatic that he more nearly resembles in his mental makeup the ox than any other type. The workman who is best suited to handling pig iron is unable to understand the real science of doing this class of work. He is so stupid that the word percentage has no meaning to him, and he must consequently be trained by a man more intelligent than himself into the habit of working in accordance with the laws of this science before he can be successful." Taylor's statement is offensive and inaccurate, but he was right in pointing out that many people do things in inefficient ways, and that small inefficiencies multiplied at industrial scale reduce productivity. The world had become vastly more complicated since the time of apprenticeships and small family-run enterprises. The level of complication had passed a threshold whereby localized improvisation and intuition could not support the magnitude of industrial endeavors. The scope and intricacy of production processes had expanded to the point that they required planners and coordinators to ensure that all the pieces came together efficiently and effectively. The rise of managers as the thinkers who would devise such blueprints and the reduction of workers to instruments of implementation seemed to follow as a natural consequence. Reductionism lay at the heart of this drive for efficiency. Taylor's approach broke work down into its simplest elements. The laying of bricks became a series of 5 discrete motions. The machining of a tire, a sequence of 12. Only the managers, the planners and coordinators, had to understand how everything came together. Such a system harnessed the gains of extreme specialization advocated in the abstract by Adam Smith and David Ricardo centuries earlier. Henry Ford's famous assembly line, which in 1913 compressed the production of a car from days to just 93 minutes by dividing the assembly process into a set of specialized roles was a natural extension of Taylor's train of thought. It is worth noting that Ford denied scientific management's influence on him. Nonetheless, it is clear that the two men's approaches derive from the foundational belief in efficiency. Military planners had relied on many of Taylor's strategies, the segregation of planning and execution, standardization, and an emphasis on efficiency, for centuries before Taylor was born. But Taylor's ideas inspired many military leaders to find fresh ways to create a more efficient fighting force. In the years leading up to World War I, European militaries constructed complicated plans for the mobilization and deployment of their massive armies, built on precisely timed rail movements. Reductionist master planners broke down offensives into the number of feet and inches that each brigade would be expected to advance each hour. Those lower down the chain of command would receive orders similar to Taylor's instruction cards. Historian A.J. P. Taylor famously dubbed this approach war by timetable. When America entered World War I, the country turned to reductionist systems to raise production of guns, bombs, and boots to unprecedented levels. Historian Samuel Haber wrote that efficiency became a patriotic duty. Taylor's advocacy of unrestrained production became common sense. When World War II broke out barely 20 years later, reductionist systems enabled tens of thousands of untrained sharecroppers to become welders and shipbuilders in the span of a few months. One year after Pearl Harbor, America's arsenal of democracy was producing war materiel, including the 7,000-ton ship the SS Frederick W. Taylor, on a scale that stunned the world. By 1945, U.S. factories had churned out 310,000 aircraft, 124,000 ships, 60,973 tanks versus 19,326 by Germany, and mind-numbing quantities of trucks, rifles, uniforms, and ammunition. Peter Drucker, the sage of modern management, argued that without Taylor's innovations, America would have been unable to defeat the Nazis. For Taylor, efficiency was far more than a mere set of business practices. It was a mental revolution applicable to the mundane. He experimented persistently with the most efficient way to make scrambled eggs. The trivial, an avid tennis player, he spent years optimizing the angle of his racket and eventually won the precursor for the U.S. Open, and the geopolitical. In his words, "The same principles of scientific management can be applied with equal force to all social activities, to the management of our homes, the management of our farms, the management of the business of our tradesmen, large and small, of our churches, our philanthropic institutions, our universities, and our governmental departments." On the domestic front, as well as in war, government took an active role in promoting Taylor's doctrine. In 1910, when a group of powerful railroads petitioned the government for a rate hike, the Supreme Court determined that they did not need it. If the railroads just adopted Taylor's scientific management, they could save up to $1 million a day, more than they would have gained with the rate hike. The lawyer, who represented the consumer in the case, Louis Brandeis, who would later be appointed to the Supreme Court, wrote, "Of all the social and economic movements with which I have been connected, none seems to me to be equal to scientific management in its importance and hopefulness." Historian Glenn Porter explains, "Scientific management took on some of the trappings of a kind of secular religion. Taylor was the Messiah, and his followers, who spread the word, were, and still are, commonly referred to as disciples. In the 1910s, these disciples descended on factories, mills, and plants across America, ushering in a new era of measured optimization." One, Robert Kent, wrote, No group of crusaders ever battled for their cause with greater energy, greater faith, than the men in this movement, in those early days, battled for scientific management. These acolytes reduced all sorts of domains to neatly defined sets of scientific principles. Henri Fayol, a mining engineer, wrote a dissertation called Industrial and General Administration, in which he reduced management to five elements: planning, organizing, command, coordination, and control. Social scientists Luther Gulick and Lyndall Urwick determined that the responsibilities of government leadership were to plan, to organize, to direct staff, to coordinate, to report, and to budget. Taylor touted his advances as a universal panacea. In my judgment, Taylor wrote, the best possible measure of the height in the scale of civilization to which any people has arisen is its productivity. He believed his mental revolution would lead to the substitution of peace for war, the substitution of hearty brotherly cooperation for contention and strife, of both pulling hard in the same direction instead of pulling apart, of replacing suspicious watchfulness with mutual confidence, or becoming friends instead of enemies. Biographer and historian Robert Canigal writes that, by the late 1920s, it could seem that all of modern society had come under the sway of a single commanding idea, that waste was wrong, and efficiency the highest good, and that eliminating one and achieving the other was best left to the experts. Journalist Ida Tarbell went so far as to argue, no man in the history of American industry has made a larger contribution to genuine cooperation and juster human relations than did Frederick Winslow Taylor. He is one of the few creative geniuses of our time. In the decades since, Taylor's star has dimmed. His treatment of workers has been widely decried, as has his conception of individuals as mechanistic entities to be manipulated. In the 1960s, MIT professor Douglas McGregor's Theory X and Theory Y of Human Resource Management offered a famous critique of Taylorist principles. In McGregor's view, Taylor's approach, X, saw humans as fundamentally lazy and in need of financial incentives and close monitoring in order to do work, while McGregor's own theory, Y, understood people as capable of self-motivation and self-control, and argued that managers would achieve better results by treating their employees with respect. Nevertheless, Taylor's foundational belief, the notion that an effective enterprise is created by commitment to efficiency and that the role of the manager is to break things apart and plan the one best way, remains relatively unchallenged. The question of the treatment of labor is an argument over the appropriate means to that agreed-upon end. We might recoil today at the brutal consequences of mechanized warfare and the dehumanizing connotations of the assembly line, but the principles that undergird these systems remain firmly embedded in the way organizations of all types approach management and leadership. We still search faithfully for the one best way to do things. We still think of organizational leaders as planners, synchronizers, and coordinators, chess player strategists responsible for overseeing interlocking troop movements, marketing initiatives, or global supply chains. The structures of our organizations reflect this ideal. Whether imbued with a lazy worker theory X or a motivated worker theory Y disposition, the org charts of most multi-person endeavors look pretty similar. A combination of specialized vertical columns, departments or divisions, and horizontal tiers that denote levels of authority, with the most powerful literally on top, the only tier that can access all columns. At the top, we envision the strategic decision-making. At the bottom, we imagine action by those taking direction. The efficiency, strength, and logic that we are inclined to see in such a chart is a natural extension of the separation of planning from execution. From our conception of leadership to the form of our organizations, reductionism laid the foundation of contemporary management. We no longer tell secretaries how to paperclip pages together, but we do read dozens of online articles that promise 5 ways to make your day more efficient or 7 tips to maximize your productivity. We believe that the reductionist sum of everyone being their most productive will lead to the best overall results. We love the idea of a best practice. Historians attribute to Taylorism the advent of modern time consciousness, the transformation of leisure from unstructured free time to organized recreation, and the approach to managing the federal bureaucracy championed by the Reagan administration. Critic Christopher Lash argued that Taylorism ushered in a new interpretation of the American dream. A Taylor disciple writing in the 1940s acknowledged that despite all the effort they poured into their crusade, he and his peers never would have dreamed that in less than a quarter of a century, the principles of scientific management would be so woven into the fabric of our industrial life that they would be accepted as commonplace, that plants would be operating under the principles of scientific management without knowing it. Plants, perhaps, that had never heard of Taylor. Peter Drucker argued that Taylor, more than Karl Marx, deserves a place in the pantheon of modern intellectual thought alongside Darwin and Freud. Taylor changed not only the way our world is organized, but the way we think about solving problems. Historian Jeremy Rifkin believes, Taylor has probably had a greater effect on the private and public lives of the men and women of the 20th century than any other single individual. The Awesome Machine. If Taylor could have been plucked from the turn of the last century, brought to Iraq at the turn of this one, and given a tour of our task force's facilities, he would have been delighted. Operators and units shifted in and out of the fight like clockwork. On the night of a unit rotation, hundreds of personnel would arrive to the fight. Those they were replacing would depart the following day, and all these movements would occur without reducing our ability to continue missions in the field. Helicopters and other air assets would fly quite literally to the last possible minute before requiring upkeep, and would travel back to the United States on the same transport aircraft that had just a few hours prior brought freshly tuned helicopters into the fight. Pilots would step from one cockpit to another without missing a beat. Operators' weapons and personal kits sat in precise rows in the pathway between their sleeping quarters and the departure point for missions, enabling them to launch at a moment's notice and creating a common area for updates to be given to the team. From major equipment to the placement of gear on the individual operator, everything about our system screamed efficiency and precision. It was, as we often said, an awesome machine. An assembly line for counterterrorism. This fastidious synchronization across forces had been learned the hard way, through the humiliating failure of Operation Eagle Claw, the 1980 attempt to rescue hostages being held in our embassy in Tehran. In the first stage of a torturously complicated operation to reach, secure, and extract the Americans who had been held captive in the occupied embassy compound for 5 months, misfortune struck. In a remote part of the Iranian desert, a Navy helicopter flown by a Marine pilot collided with an Air Force cargo plane loaded with Army commandos, dooming the mission before the force got within 200 miles of its target. In the aftermath, the Holloway Commission, appointed by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to review the failure, recommended the creation of a specially focused joint task force to coordinate and plan American special operations. It was a never-again mentality. We needed a new management tier at the top, a new level of reductionist architects of process to ensure that things clicked together with the precision of Taylor's factory floor at Midvale. Our task force, bringing the different military branches' elite teams under one command, was the result. When I took command in 2003, the task force was deeply involved in what was termed the Global War on Terror, GWAT. Operations spanned a wide swath of Africa, the Middle East, and Southwest Asia, but the largest commitment was focused on Iraq. In the aftermath of the initial invasion, we had assumed primary responsibility for targeting senior former leaders of the fallen Saddam Hussein government, made famous by the deck of cards unveiled in March 2003, a collection of playing card-sized cards with the names and photographs of 55 Ba'athist leaders designated for capture. At first, it had seemed straightforward. We had little trouble gathering up the paunchy, chain-smoking men who had apparently served as stalwart henchmen of an odious dictator. But Zarqawi's insurgency, a different type of threat, was already growing in size and sophistication. In 2003, it was not yet clear that AQI was the primary agent coalescing resistance, but the rumblings could be felt like distant thunder on a summer afternoon. A storm was approaching. Our planned reductionist precision might have been an outstanding organizational solution for 20th century problems, but we were now fighting in a new era. By early spring of 2004, we understood that Iraq would be different. Special operations forces were designed to employ uniquely skilled operators in small numbers for carefully timed raids executed with rapier-like exactitude. Correctly done, such operations were the ultimate symbol of efficiency and to be used sparingly. But as the scope and complexity of the fight grew, it became clear that AQI's surprising breadth and agility demanded increased reliance on the tactical flexibility that only special operations units could provide. Success of the larger mission in Iraq demanded we take on a role at a scale and sustained intensity that were unprecedented, with no discernible end in sight. Not only the scale of the fight was new, the tools were as well. The development of new information technologies, precision weapons, GPS, night vision, and other advances were also changing how we fought. Descending from blacked-out helicopters that could locate a specific rooftop in a sea of buildings with pinpoint accuracy, operators communicated via headsets with pilots controlling unmanned aerial vehicles that provided constant video surveillance and, after capturing their target, employed biometric data collection to confirm his identity. The process that drove our operations in Iraq was a sequence that became known as F3EA, Find, Fix, Finish, Exploit, Analyze. It was simple in concept, and much of it was as old as warfare itself. First, the target needed to be found. Then its position would need to be fixed so that we could know where it was in real time. The operators would then finish the target, removing the threat from the battlefield. Next, the target would be exploited for any intelligence. A house might be searched, a person interrogated, and finally, intelligence would be analyzed. Then the cycle would begin again. It derived from similar targeting and decision-making processes like the well-known OODA loop, observe, orient, decide, assess, that became associated with fighter pilots, that sought to increase the effectiveness of operations by continually refining understanding of the situation. At first, we had to adjust to the speed and scale of this fight. We had traditionally functioned in a slower rhythm, conducting occasional, exquisitely planned, surgical strikes. But now we were conducting operations nearly every day, often doing multiple raids simultaneously. We quickly came up to speed. This type of work was not fundamentally new, just the same old thing at a larger magnitude. Within a few months, we had built our awesome machine. But there were warning signs. We were being asked to take on a new role with unfamiliar tools in an environment that we didn't fully comprehend. Appreciating the magnitude of what one doesn't know, as the reader will see, proves to be a major theme in this book. In 2004, we did not yet understand this maxim. While efficient on a scale that the challengers we faced could never have imagined, we were beginning to understand that the new world was not just incrementally different from the old one in a way that could be fixed with a new, yet more intricate set of precise instructions delivered from on high. Our efficient systems provided us with a solid foundation, but they could not bring us victory. This new world required a fundamental rewriting of the rules of the game. In order to win, we would have to set aside many of the lessons that millennia of military procedure and a century of optimized efficiencies had taught us. Lessons of the Last War. In 1930, France began construction of its famed Maginot Line, named for the Minister of War and World War I veteran André Maginot. Like millions of his countrymen, Maginot had seen firsthand the death, disease, and suffering of static trench warfare. As the Holloway Commission would do decades later, he applied never-again thinking to avoid repeating the horrors of the past. Built over 10 years, the Maginot Line was a modern-day version of the Great Wall of China, an impenetrable system of tunnels, resupply routes, and interlocking fields of fire for both individual soldiers and large artillery. Its various subterranean floors included not only soldiers' quarters, but hospitals, telephone bureaus, and even a subway. Running the length of the Franco-German border and extending 10 to 12 miles below ground, it was a marvel of military planning and an intimidating deterrent to any invaders coming from the east. In 1940, the Germans approached the line and stopped. Their maneuver, a feint. Simultaneously, panzer divisions knifed through Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, neutral countries that could offer no substantial defense. Aided by improvements in tank technology, German forces could now move far faster than the columns of troops in World War I. They blazed through the lowlands and struck France from the north in a flanking maneuver around the impenetrable but immovable Maginot Line. The Luftwaffe simply flew over it. Outflanked and stunned, France surrendered in less than 2 months. Today, the Maginot Line is often used as a metaphor for stupidity, but the reality is complicated. The line largely worked as designed. The muddy trenches and carnage of World War I did not reappear, and Germany was unable to mount a land invasion via the Franco-German border. Arguably, had the line not been built, the Germans might have taken a more direct route into France and achieved victory even more swiftly. But despite its formidability, André Maginot's creation was insufficient for a new environment of tanks, airplanes, and an enemy command that chose not to play by the rules. Instead of deterring a German attack, it helped stimulate a new type of war. In 2004, as we planned clockwork raids designed to make the most of every drop of fuel, we were manning a managerial Maginot Line. Our extraordinarily efficient procedures and plans were well-crafted and necessary, but not sufficient. Like the proverbial general always fighting the last war, the French had crafted a solution to avoid the pain of World War I, and we had designed an organization that could avoid repeating the embarrassment of Eagle Claw. And just as the development of the tank changed the realities of military defense, the proliferation of new information age technologies rendered Taylorist efficiency an outdated managerial paradigm. Over the past century, the kind of organizational measures that ensure the success of combat parachute assaults have proliferated throughout the military, industry, and business. In today's environment, however, these solutions are the equivalent of the provincial apprenticeship models that Taylor stumbled upon in 1874. In Iraq, the inexplicable networked success of our under-resourced enemy indicated that they had cracked this nut before we had. Managerially, AQI was flanking us.
Recap. Our task force's structure and culture of disciplined, stratified reductionism had its roots deep in military organizational history. This organizational culture is not unique to the military. Since the Industrial Revolution, most industries have subscribed to management doctrines informed by or similar to Frederick Taylor's scientific management, a system that is excellent for achieving highly efficient execution of known, repeatable processes at scale. We were realizing in 2004 that despite the success of this approach throughout the 20th century, it had its limits. Like the Maginot Line, it was insufficient for tackling a new generation of threats. Efficiency is no longer enough.
Chapter 3. From Complicated to Complex. The year is 1882. Halfway around the world from Taylor and his factories, the Ottoman governor of Damascus has decided to implement major educational reforms. Tariq, a poor, pious Muslim who resents the reforms, goes down to the town square, gets on a soapbox, and begins to agitate against the government. Do the authorities need to worry about him? Perhaps. In all likelihood, the Ottoman regime knows almost nothing about him personally because he is not well connected or aligned with any of their institutional enemies. But even without knowledge about Tariq as an individual, the regime can anticipate that the number of people who might turn out to see him preach is small. Only people who are within daily communication and traveling radius of his soapbox will be aware of his protest. Moreover, the town square lies within government control. If things get out of hand, they can shut down the operation almost instantly. Maybe they will arrest him, or maybe they will let him say his piece and leave. Either way, they can predict with some accuracy that he does not represent a threat to the state. Fast forward to 2010, and Tariq is standing on the street in Sidi Bouzid, Tunisia. He is shouting at the top of his lungs about local police corruption. With access to his data trail, 21st century Tunisian authorities may know a lot about Tariq, where he shops, what he likes to buy, what websites he visits at the internet cafe, who his Facebook friends are, what kind of religious and political beliefs he holds. With simple study and a basic computer, they can come to far more refined conclusions about him than the Ottoman governor in 1882 could have. But in 2010, the range of outcomes that this Tariq can generate is far greater than his government can anticipate, because he lives in a vastly more complex world. The first Tariq is fictional. The second is Tunisian fruit vendor Tariq Altayeb Mohamed Bouazizi. And when he douses himself with gasoline and self-immolates, events spiral out of control at breakneck speed. A crowd protests his death, and his cousin records the scene on his iPhone. Videos appear on YouTube within 2 days, along with a picture of Tariq aflame and dying. More protests erupt. Videos of those protests wind up on Facebook. Arabs everywhere see their Tunisian brethren in the streets. Not only Al Jazeera, but the New York Times and The Guardian make trips to the small town of Sidi Bouzid. Within 3 months, the 30-year reign of Hosni Mubarak is brought to an end some 1,400 miles away in Cairo. Muammar Gaddafi starts losing control of Libya after 4 decades in power, and Syria begins its descent into intractable civil war. Despite having more data about Arab societies and about individuals like Tariq than at any time in history, no government, search engine, or social media platform foresaw Tariq's self-immolation or the impact it would have. The two Tariqs illustrate the contradiction between the tremendous technological progress witnessed during the past century and our seemingly diminished ability to know what will happen next. Though we know far more about everything in it, the world has in many respects become less predictable. Such unpredictability has happened not in spite of technological progress, but because of it. The technological developments of recent decades are of a fundamentally different variety from those of Taylor's era. While we might think that our increased ability to track, measure, and communicate with people like Tariq would improve our precise clockwork universe management, the reality is the opposite. These changes produce a radically different climate, one of unpredictable complexity, that stymies organizations based on Taylorist efficiency. It is because of these changes that the task force's awesome machine, excellent by all 20th century metrics, was failing. Understanding specifically what had changed, why it reduced predictability, and how that impacted management would prove critical to solving our problem. And we weren't alone. In our later analyses, we found that phenomena we witnessed on the ground in Iraq had been observed in a wide variety of domains, from agronomy to economics. Comets and cold fronts. Getting a handle on the problem of the two Tariqs begins with the story of an eclectic mathematician and meteorologist working at MIT in 1961. Edward Lorenz had been using then-cutting-edge computers to try to crack weather for about a year. Weather was a tricky problem. While events, such as the return of Halley's Comet, could be precisely calculated decades in advance, and tides and eclipses had surrendered long ago to scientific prediction, weather remained elusive. Lorenz hoped that the new technology would enable him to find a similar level of clockwork determinism in the Earth's climate. He ran computer simulations, created rudimentary graphics to better visualize the trends in his data, and hoped to discern some sort of pattern. One day, Lorenz took a shortcut in order to re-examine one particular simulation. Instead of running the whole sequence from the beginning, computers were much slower, he began halfway through. He keyed in the numbers from an earlier printout himself to make sure the initial conditions were exactly the same, then went off to grab a cup of coffee, giving the machine time to spit out its new predictions. The new run should have duplicated the earlier one exactly, as Lorenz had made no changes and had double-checked all of the inputs himself. But when he saw the new printout, he was astonished. It diverged so wildly from its predecessor that the pair seemed to be two random weathers out of a hat. Lorenz pored over his results, searching for a bug somewhere in the code or in his computer. After weeks of analysis, he found the culprit. It wasn't in the code or the machine. It was in the data. The two identical simulations he had run were actually very slightly different. The original sequence that caught Lorenz's attention had been produced by the algorithm. The computer's memory stored 6 decimal places for any value. But Lorenz had entered the reproduced sequence from the printout, which displayed only 3. He did not foresee a problem in entering the printout's rounded-off numbers, assuming that the difference between 0.506127 and 0.506 would be inconsequential. In a clockwork universe, it would have been inconsequential. The calculations that had successfully predicted eclipses, tides, and comets behave in straightforward ways. A small error in input data would lead to a small error in prediction, forecasting an eclipse a few minutes early or late. But weather is different. Lorenz's tiny rounding error existed in a more interdependent and volatile environment than the void through which Halley's comet orbits. Tiny eddies of air can be influenced by an almost immeasurably small event, something like the fluttering of a butterfly's wings, and these eddies can affect larger currents, which in turn alter the way cold and warm fronts build, a chain of events that can magnify the initial disturbance exponentially, thereby completely undermining attempts to make reliable predictions. Lorenz's program had been correct. When, several years later, Lorenz presented a paper about his findings, he titled it, "Does the Flap of a Butterfly's Wings in Brazil Set Off a Tornado in Texas?" The phrase, "the butterfly effect," entered the world. Contrary to popular belief, the concept's origins do not lie in Ray Bradbury's 1952 short story, A Sound of Thunder. However, the story does capture a version of the same phenomenon. In it, mankind of the near future uses a time machine to leap back thousands of years and hunt dinosaurs. Hunters cannot bring their prey back to the 20th century or even step foot on the prehistoric ground while on the hunt. They have built levitating pathways because of the danger that tampering with the past could negatively influence the present. One hunt goes wrong, and the hunter slips, stepping briefly off the pathway and crushing a butterfly before hopping back on. When he and his guides return to the present day, there was a thing to the air, a chemical taint so subtle, so slight that only a faint cry of his subliminal senses warned him it was there. Language is used differently. A different man has been elected president. The death of a butterfly, relayed and magnified by eons of ecosystem twists and turns, resulted in a different society. Lorenz's butterfly effect is a physical manifestation of the phenomenon of complexity. Not complexity in the sense that we use the term in daily life, a catch-all for things that are not simple or intuitive, but complexity in a more restrictive, technical, and baffling sense. This kind of complexity is difficult to define. Those who study it often fall back on Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart's comment on obscenity, "I know it when I see it." Things that are complex, living organisms, ecosystems, national economies, have a diverse array of connected elements that interact frequently. Because of this density of linkages, complex systems fluctuate extremely and exhibit unpredictability. In the case of weather, a small disturbance in one place could trigger a series of responses that build into unexpected and severe outcomes in another place because of the billions of tiny interactions that link the origin and the outcome. In an ecosystem, one slightly mutated virus may spread like wildfire, causing a huge population depletion that, in turn, propagates through the food chain, transforming the local biological order. In the case of economies, the capsizing of a single bank can have no effect at all, or cause cascading failure throughout the system. Being complex is different from being complicated. Things that are complicated may have many parts, but those parts are joined, one to the next, in relatively simple ways. One cog turns, causing the next one to turn as well, and so on. The workings of a complicated device like an internal combustion engine might be confusing, but they ultimately can be broken down into a series of neat and tidy deterministic relationships. By the end, you will be able to predict with relative certainty what will happen when one part of the device is activated or altered. Complexity, on the other hand, occurs when the number of interactions between components increases dramatically. The interdependencies that allow viruses and bank runs to spread, this is where things quickly become unpredictable. Think of the break in a pool game, the first forceful strike of the colored balls with the white cue ball. Although there are only 16 balls on the table and the physics is that of simple mechanics, it is almost impossible to predict where everything will end up. In a perfect world, with an impossibly level table, balls that were identical down to the micron, and a player who could strike with the precision of 1/1000th of a degree, a computer could foresee where the balls would slow to a halt. However, introduce even the slightest deviation in the trajectory of a single ball, and quickly all the balls that it touches and all the balls that they touch will diverge. The density of interactions means that even a relatively small number of elements can quickly defy prediction. Because of these dense interactions, complex systems exhibit non-linear change. Linear phenomena are those whose output is proportional to input. You can put $100 or $200 into a set of bonds that will give you a 5% return in 5 years. Doubling your input will double your eventual profit from $5 to $10. The change in outcome is proportional to the change in income. Such a function could be represented mathematically as y equals 1.05x. Human minds feel at home with linear functions. Nonlinear functions, on the other hand, make us uncomfortable. They come in many forms, including exponential functions like y equals 5x. And they quickly defy our intuitive understandings of growth and scale. Initial differences in the base or slight increases or decreases in x have massive consequences. When we invest money in a risky stock, we are resigning ourselves to the nonlinear capriciousness of a complex system, the stock market, where a single news story or a rogue trader across the world can cause a stock to plummet, skyrocket, or flatline. To grasp how quickly nonlinear situations can spiral beyond our capacity to comprehend or predict, consider a game of chess. Chess is rule-bound, and the number of possible moves is limited. But it is interdependent. What happens to one piece changes the relationships between and the behavior of the others. Jonathan Schaefer has calculated that there are 197,742 different ways for the player's first two turns to transpire. By the third move, the number of possibilities has risen to 121 million. Within 20 moves, it is more than likely that you are playing a game that has never been played before. Nobody knows exactly how many games of chess potentially exist because, according to Schaefer, the figure is so huge that no one will invest the effort to calculate the exact number. A small change at the start of a chess game, say, moving a pawn to A3 instead of A4, can lead to a completely different result. Just as the flapping of one of Lorenz's butterflies might create huge nonlinear havoc down the line. A reductionist instruction card would be useless for playing chess. The interactions generate too many possibilities. The significance of Lorenz's butterfly effect is not, however, just the nonlinear escalation of a minor input into a major output. There's uncertainty involved. The amplification of the disturbance is not the product of a single, constant, identifiable magnifying factor. Any number of seemingly insignificant inputs might or might not result in non-linear escalation. If every butterfly's fluttering always led to a hurricane halfway across the world 2 days later, weather would be predictable, if insane. The butterfly's fluttering leads to a storm only if thousands of other minor conditions are just right, and those conditions are so precise as to be practically immeasurable, rendering the outcome unpredictable. According to Taylor's idea of efficiency, an understanding of the initial conditions of a system and the forces at play within it enables managers to compute the end result. But in a complex system with dense interconnections, even one as seemingly clockwork as a chess game, one would need an impossible resolution of data in order to make reliable medium to long-run predictions. There are causes for the events in a complex system, but there are so many causes and so many events linked to one another through so many direct and indirect paths that the outcome is practically unpredictable, even if it is theoretically deterministic. As Lorenz explained, if a little flap could lead to a tornado that would not otherwise have happened, it could equally well prevent a tornado that would otherwise have formed. The weather in his example depends on the myriad other interdependent variables with which that flapping wing would directly and indirectly interact. As a result, compared with something like the trajectory of a comet, the development of weather has a far, far wider range of potential outcomes. In popular culture, the term butterfly effect is almost always misused. It has become synonymous with leverage, the idea of a small thing that has a big impact, with the implication that, like a lever, it can be manipulated to a desired end. This misses the point of Lorenz's insight. The reality is that small things in a complex system may have no effect or a massive one, and it is virtually impossible to know which will turn out to be the case. This broad spectrum of possible outcomes throws a wrench into the conceptual clockwork. In the task force, as in most large organizations, our actions were the product of our planning, and our planning was predicated on our ability to predict, or more precisely, our perception of our ability to predict, our belief that we understood the workings of the clock. But by 2004, our battlefield behaved a lot more like the capricious movements of a cold front than like the steady trajectory of Halley's Comet. New communications technologies had joined individuals like Tarek to millions of others in a dense tangle of interconnectedness. These events and actors were not only more interdependent than in previous wars, they were also faster. The environment was not just complicated. It was complex. Emmylou's Wayward Swirl. My granddaughter, Emmylou, was born on June 4, 2014. She will grow up in a world defined by the near instant transmission of information and rapid transportation of people, goods, and services. She is a digital native, while I will always remain, at best, the holder of a green card. I do not know how she will perceive the differences between real and virtual presence, but I know she will navigate these converging spheres differently and far more deftly than previous generations. The very social fabric of her world is being woven with the fiber-optic cables of social media, a shift whose consequences we cannot begin to predict. The world of Emmylou is one that many could have scarcely imagined 20 years ago. Products, events, nations, phenomena, and individuals have become more connected to, dependent on, and influenced by one another than ever before. Boeing's primary assembly of its 787 Dreamliner, for instance, requires about 1,000 workers at its Everett, Washington plant. But It depends on wings from Nagoya, Japan. Horizontal stabilizers from Foggia, Italy. Cargo and access doors from Sweden, wingtips from Korea, and landing gear from Gloucester, United Kingdom. Like most of what we buy or use, any given Dreamliner is the product of a vast network of sources. The increased interdependence that goes into creating our physical products is nothing compared with the leaps in digital connectivity witnessed in recent years. The rise of crowdsourced fundraising campaigns, viral online trends, and mobile payment systems testifies that the spread of technology has brought almost all of us into a much broader web of connectivity than we were in a decade or two ago. In Iraq, we saw this rise in interdependence manifested almost daily. An operation in one city would lead almost instantly to a chain reaction of AQI actions and civilian responses across the country. The tiniest rumors, sometimes true, sometimes not, would spread like wildfire through online forums. At the same time, almost all processes have become much, much faster. Tiny increments of time now spell the difference between success and failure. Keeping up with the increased pace of news was a problem not just for our task force. It presents a challenge for almost all organizations, especially those actually in the news business. A century ago, at newspaper offices, beat reporters would write about assigned topics. Editors would review the stories, and the editor-in-chief would look over the final product before sending it to press. Breaking a story meant getting it out a full day before the competition. Fast forward to March 17, 2014, when the Los Angeles Times was the first news company to break a story about a nearby earthquake. Their edge? The article was written entirely by a robot, a computer program that scans streams of data like that from the U.S. Geological Survey and puts together short pieces faster than any newsroom chain of command could. This program earned the paper a few minutes of lead time at most. But today, those minutes are critical. In New York, commercial realtors charge a premium for co-located financial real estate that places traders nearer to servers, allowing them to shave microseconds off near-light-speed transactions. For similar reasons, a group of American and European trading firms recently spent $300 million on a new transatlantic cable that will decrease trade time by 5.2 milliseconds. One young banker summed up the rationale behind going to such lengths to procure seemingly minuscule advantages. Speed is money. Speed has always been important to armies, but for most of history it was limited to what a horse or a human could do. The Romans built excellent roads to facilitate military movement, but even a crack legion could only go about 20 miles a day. During the Civil War, Confederate General Thomas Jonathan Stonewall Jackson's troops earned the moniker Foot Cavalry after they covered 646 miles over a 48-day period. But the fastest speed they achieved was 6 miles per hour, and that was for a limited duration forced march. Most people not carrying a weapon and pack walk comfortably at about 3 miles per hour. For soldiers to march 6 miles per hour, 10 minutes per mile, requires an uncomfortable and unsustainable for most people jog walk. In the 20th century, automobiles, tanks, and eventually airplanes, jets, and rocketry changed the speed of war dramatically. But the ones and zeros of the digital world fly still faster. When we read about new technologies or hear about the promise of a globalized, interconnected world, we tend to assume that technological advances will enable us to do what we have always done, only better. But there is a second side to this coin. The same technologies that provided organizations like the task force with enhanced transportation, communication, and data abilities simultaneously imbue our operating environment with escalating non-linearity, complexity, and unpredictability. Speed and interdependence together mean that any given action in any given time frame is now linked to vastly more potential outcomes than the same action a century or even a few decades ago. Endeavors that were once akin to a two- or three-ball pool problem now involve hundreds of collisions. Boeing might gain in efficiency by outsourcing its production processes, but that outsourcing also means that events in a dozen countries across three continents have the power to disrupt